Hi there, it's News Talk's Andrea Gilligan here.
We talk a lot about health, but your gut is where it all begins. A balanced gut can improve everything from your digestion and energy to your immune system and even your mood. That's why Simproof, Ireland's number one for gut health, is such a game changer. And right now, for Black Friday, you can get 25% off their live and active bacteria supplement. Each daily shot is packed with billions of friendly bacteria that actually reach your gut alive and start working to restore balance where it matters most. No capsules, no powders, just a refreshing, water-based drink in four great flavours. Take it first thing each morning, 10 minutes before food or drink, and start feeling the difference. A healthy gut supports your whole body, so don't miss 25% off Simproof's 12 and 4-week programmes now at simproof.ie. Now, enjoy the podcast.
At Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr, we're all about celebrating the journey of life and leadership, no matter what stage you're at. And that's where our partners at Standard Life come in. For decades, Standard Life have been helping people navigate life's most important transitions, from planning your financial future to embracing the opportunities that come with a new chapter in life. Whether you're starting your career or nearing retirement, Standard Life is there. Working with financial advisors, they help you plan for your life journey and do it with confidence. Because getting you ready for your best second life involves financial planning, but it's also about making sure you're ready to live it well. So wherever you are at in your life or career, let Standard Life help you plan for tomorrow while enjoying today. Visit standardlife.ie to find out more about planning for your best second life. Standard Life International DAC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr.
A News Talk original.
Brought to you by Standard Life, a life savings company for your journey to and through retirement.
On this week's episode of Life and Leadership, I'm delighted to be joined by the co-founders of the It's a Bagel brand, Domini and Peaches Kemp. Good morning, ladies. How are you?
Good morning.
Now, my first question is, who's the big sister and who's the little sister? That doesn't... We'll keep it as general as that.
All right, Peaches, I'm the big sister.
Okay. And tell me this, were ye posh girls growing up?
Oh my God, Bobby, that's a loaded question for this time of the morning. Were we posh girls? Ah, sure, we like, you know, the nice things in life, but you know, no.
Well, I know Domini was into horse riding and equestrian pursuits and all that. Is that right, Domini?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, we both were, in fairness, but I think that in my mid-20s, I realised a professional career with the horses was going to be too hard, and Peaches had already started with the cooking background and had started her own catering business. And I think at that point then I really thought, you know what, cooking is a lot easier than the horses and a little bit more steady Eddie.
That was one of life's crossroads then. Can I bring you back a bit? Because you were both born in the Bahamas, is that right?
Yeah.
And was it an Irish mother and a Scottish father?
Yeah.
That's got to be an interesting family.
It was.
Tell us more about the early days.
Well, I suppose, you know, where you're born just becomes your natural habitat. And the Bahamas was a really lovely habitat to grow up in. Island life, very different from, you know, the life that we now have in Ireland. But, you know, it was absolutely lovely. And, you know, parents that worked hard and also, you know, brought us travelling a lot and came over here for the summers. So the Bahamas was very special, but Ireland is equally special.
So there was always that Irish connection through your mother, was that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, as Peter said, very idyllic childhood, but we were very familiar with Ireland coming over here every summer. And so when our dad died in the early 80s, Mum still had family over here, and it was a no-brainer for her to say, right, let's go home from her point of view. So we got to basically spend most of our teenage and young lives then here from an early start.
So was there a brief period in Virginia where you did attended high school? Was that you, Peaches?
That was yeah, me, that was me, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So you had experience of the American education system.
Yeah, absolutely. And was supposed to go back to university there, actually, but then decided really at that stage that, you know, my family, as in Dominie and Mum, were here in Ireland. So going back over to the States was going to be, you know, just too far. So, stayed here.
So then you're here in Ireland. You had decided, Dominie, that the equestrian pursuit wasn't to be. You trained with Prue Leith, is that right?
That's right, yeah. So Leith was a really good cookery school in London, and you were also able to get a foot in the door of a lot of good restaurants in London. So I did the year chef course there and then started working in some London restaurants, and then came home one weekend, met my former partner, Conrad Gallagher, and we met, and I ended up moving home and working alongside him for about 3 years then.
Yeah, and they were, I suppose, heady days. It's probably, it's probably when you look back on those years, that was like there was something happening, was there not?
There really was.
In terms of Ireland and food.
Absolutely. And it's funny because we were mentioning the 100 best restaurants recently, and we're saying how much it's changed. But, you know, I remember that was, you know, John and Sally McKenna, they were the restaurant critics for the Irish Times back then. And, you know, the paper, you could really make or break a restaurant with a positive review back in the time. But it was the 90s, you know, Dublin, the whole food scene hadn't really kicked off. Gilbo's was still, you know, the big name in town, still is, you know, to a large extent. They've had a phenomenal career and trajectory.
And one of the survivors, too.
Yeah, an amazing, amazing establishment. But Gilbo's was the fine dining place back then. And Conrad arrived in the scene fresh from New York and working for Alain Ducasse in Monte Carlo. And he opened up Peacock Alley. And so he was seen as this sort of enfant terrible of the dining scene. He was kind of, I guess, giving two fingers for that old kind of very French traditional formal type of dining approach. So, you know, he caused a lot of excitement, consternation, and generally shook the market up. Now, it was, you know, along with that was a lot of headaches from my point of view, but it was.
Was it
really,
chaos? Was it chaos?
It was, and I don't even want to say it was organized chaos. It was chaotic a lot of the time. And, you know, the 3 years we had together, you know, we got a Michelin star during that time. It was hugely exciting. We had amazing people working with us, and, you know, people like Denise McBrien and so on, who's in the old spot, some great chefs that have gone on, you know, and there was just a fantastic core team of people that worked their backsides off.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, Conrad, like, had come in and was just one of those people, had no financial discipline at all. So, you know, very soon we were in very deep water, and it was really when the cookbook came out and he got a shot on being on the Late Late Show, things really changed around for us during that time. And look, it was a hugely exciting time. I refer to it more as the what not to do in business period of life, you know. So it was the 3 years there was like a career of 20 years, really, in packed in.
And where were you when all this was going on, Peaches? keeping an eye on your little sister.
Keeping an eye on my little sister. Well, I was married at the time, and I was working with my husband, who was a racehorse trainer, a national hunt trainer.
Okay.
And, so I was doing that, and I had finished doing my catering at that stage to sort of dedicate myself to the horses with him. And then really around the same time, you know, unfortunately my marriage ended, and Dominie's relationship with Conrad came to a halt really, you know, almost simultaneously. And, you know, Dominie and her friends, we laugh about it, you know, back in the day when I was doing the catering, you know, it was child labour with the whole lot of them, you know what I mean?
And we're still holding a grudge.
I know, but I did pay them, you know. So anyway, so really it was at that time, because of personal circumstances, that's how we came back together. And we always wanted to do something together in terms of the catering. And that was it. It was just, it was fate, timing, everything. Just,
yeah,
just
interesting.
Together, to start company.
And when we talked then about the early model of It's a Bagel, and I remember it well. I remember going down to look at it specifically in the shop in Abbey Street, Liffey Street, Epicurean Food Hall, yes. And I remember going down to look at this and said, wow, this is something really, really special. Yeah. And one of the, I suppose, USPs was the bagels were actually imported from New York.
That is right.
Tell us more.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'll let Domini talk a little bit about it, because she went over and did a little bit of the R&D in New York.
It was, I'd gone over and Conrad and I had originally thought, oh, this would be a great thing to do. And I guess I was concerned, you know, we had three restaurants at that time and you know, this seemed like a very fun thing to do and a kind of daytime concept. So to bring an element of all that I'd learned during that time and to think, right, what would be a good, sensible daytime? Lauren was about a year old at that stage, and I knew working nights with a young child was quite challenging. And as Peach said, when we decided, you know, we're going to go into business together, you know, the idea was there. It had already started. I'd gone over to New York, had the conversation with H&H, who were the kind of one of the best known bagel companies in New York. Their bagels featured on, you know, everything from Friends to Sex and the City. And, you know, there's that famous scene where, you know, Carrie says, I got the good bagels, and that's H&H. They were the only ones that were set up for export. So I had a kind of meeting with them, and they were like, yeah, sure, you know, pay the money and you get 40,000 or 80,000 bagels. I'm not going to do the bad American New York accent. They were very laid back about the whole thing. So we kind of panicked. We were like, will we buy 40,000? Will we buy 80,000 bagels? What do we do? You know, we had to get them on a frozen container and ship them over, and customs as well were kind of scratching their heads going, what are bagels? What you know, what sort of excise duties are we going to charge? It was one of
those. No VAT, was that right? Because
it's bread,
not a confectionery.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember the argument well.
Yeah, but of course, coming from the US, there were excise duties on them. But it was like, we really, when you look back on it, we didn't have a template. There was no kind of how-to. And, you know, we had taken the unit in the Epicurean Food Hall. That was an amazing, amazing group of people who had come together to open up this food hall, which was really before its time.
Yeah, no, it was something about it as well.
It really was. And my good friend, Aidan McGrath, he helped design the interiors, which was absolutely gorgeous. Aidan had done some beautiful work in some restaurants up in Belfast. And everything just kind of landed in its place. We had a great sort of slow start, but then Louise East, who was writing for the Irish Times, you know, she decided to do a feature on us, and we told a little bit of a white lie. We had sort of said that, yeah, the bagels were so fantastic that people were coming all the way from Baggot Street to come down for their lunch. We got a great splashy piece in the Irish Times and never looked back.
And when you look back now, you know, the economics of taking a bread product of relatively low value, shipping it across the Atlantic, and then thawing it out, regenerating it for resale here, you'd kind of say, surely that won't work.
Yeah. I think, you know, what we actually, we decided ourselves is, if this doesn't work, let's have, what's the foundation of what we want to actually do, which is really good fillings. And that was, and that still is the essence of what we do today, you know, creating these combinations. And the eight signature bagels that we put on the original menu still are in existence today, with lots more added onto that. So I remember we thought, well, if bagels don't work and this doesn't take off, we'll just switch to another bread product, you know. So it's, even though, you know, we've called ourselves It's a Bagel, like, we kind of were all in at that stage. But, you know, it was what is the work? What's the plan B? And I think that was what we've always done, is what's the plan B? If this doesn't work, what's plan B? But plan A worked, which was great.
Yeah. And then from those days back in the turn of the century, let's call it now, Abbey Street, Liffey Street, 1999.
Yeah.
It looked to me that it was going to be, this was going to be built into a chain. Now, I know there was multiple expansions and maybe you brought it to what, 10 or 11 units at one stage?
I think we went to about four or five, I think,
right,
at one stage. But, we were right at the height of the Celtic Tiger.
Yeah.
And getting property was the issue for us, funnily enough. So we went from the Epicurean Food Hall to Dunleary, Fitzwilliam Street, and then we were in Ranelagh, etc. But, you know, that was always the problem, was getting property. And
yeah,
then the crash came, and then it was easy to get property. We were in Malahide, etc. So, you know, but it wasn't one of those things. We didn't want to roll it out on a huge scale either, because sometimes you lose the quality in doing that. So we were always very measured with how we wanted to do it.
And there were other brands that came, Joe Coffee, Alchemy. Some might say, were these distractors from driving on the It's a Bagel brand, as in it can be difficult to run a number of brands.
Yeah. Well, I think when
you're looking at the market and in hindsight, you know, probably one approach should have been taking on investment, which, you know, we had definitely talked about bringing on partners. Peaches and I have owned the business ourselves, right, and always self-financed and with some bank borrowing, but we've never taken on investors. There was an opportunity to do that, and we decided not to. And, so the growth was much slower. We looked at franchising, decided that wasn't going to be for us either. I think in hindsight, maybe if we'd brought on investors and really gone for it with the one brand, I think that would have been probably a lot easier in many respects.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, carbs then suddenly became a very dirty word. Mm. And, you know, you see this cycle of change where there's so little loyalty to brands now, you know, and it's new and exciting and change and different. Alchemy was really a great response to a growing demand for healthier food. I loved Alchemy. It was really great. And we see now with Sprout and some of the other chains, you know, how important that is now becoming to diners. The whole specialty coffee area, that just exploded. You know, when we think how bad coffee was in the 90s versus what it is today. So I think we were always trying to ensure that we stayed current and possibly ahead of the curve in terms of brands. But maybe the sensible business decision would have been take on investment and really go with It to Bagel and really roll that out. But
in equestrian terms, you can only ride one horse. But again, that's hindsight, isn't it?
Yeah, but you know, with I suppose the background that we both had with catering and certainly the kind of fine dining and restaurant experience, it meant that we were able to do feast catering and events, and that's turned into an amazing company doing events and weddings, and is a hugely successful part of what we do. So I don't think we've any regrets. I think we both think that maybe we could have taken different courses, but like it has been exciting, and I think creatively, which is it's such a huge and important part of what we do, we've been able to stay really challenged and feel that we've contributed to the food landscape in a meaningful way.
You mentioned Feast, and we're here in Sandyford, which I think is the epicenter of operations. And this central of operations, Peaches, that effectively produces food for It's a Bagel. It's multifunctional in that sense.
It is. It is the epicenter. It's the hub. It's the Starship Enterprise, basically. And the vans leave here every night and bring food out to It's a Bagel. But we also run the Commons in Molly. And we work in, we do the catering in the College of Physicians on Kildare Street, as well as Powers Court House, which is absolutely the most beautiful location for events and weddings. But we also have a B2B contract with Butler's Chocolates, and we do a lot of their sandwiches and a lot of their goodies as well. So this has really become a hub of activity. And, you know, I suppose, you know, as Dominic was saying, we've done many things over the years, but, you know, the beauty of trying things and seeing things that work and don't work is you know, when you see the value, you do know what does work. And that's, I think, where we've got to now. It's like we've refined it, concentrated and focused on
the things that really do.
And if you look at maybe, you know, something like you mentioned there, producing sandwiches for others, you're working quietly there in the background. Yeah. You're not really trying to get your name out there per se. Mm. But, you know, there's a lot of sandwiches being produced out of here.
A huge amount,
yeah. And that's all fine.
Yeah.
Because it allows you to do other things as well.
Mm. And, you know, I think the other thing that we've that we're really proud of that we've established over the 25 years is the partnerships that we've had. You know, so Butler's Toxics is a lovely partnership. You know, we're It's Bagels and Arnott's. That's a lovely partnership with the BT Group, you know, with the Museum of Literature, with the College of Physicians. All of these are lovely partnerships, and it enables, and Paris Court, we've been in Paris Court since 2009, and that is a really special partnership that we have. So we love working with people who have the same ethos as we do.
And speaking of leadership, partnerships are often, you know, they're often a really, I suppose, solid way of existing and growing a business.
Yeah.
Sometimes with partners, you can, if you choose them wisely, you can punch way above your weight. And what do you look for in a partnership?
I think trust and honesty is huge. I think it's quality for us, it's people who want to do things well. We want to do things well. So it's people that, you know, it's not just about producing food to feed the masses and, you know, at the bottom line and bumping along the bottom. The partners that we have really value quality. They value loyalty. They value integrity. And I think integrity is probably the one thing that you look for in a partner more than anything else.
Yeah, yeah. Dominie, your own career, I suppose, took a slight trajectory in a positive way in writing the food writing that you did all those years in the Irish Times. Tell us a little bit about your years there and how important that piece of your work was to the bigger picture.
Yeah, I think you know, food writing has just been something I just have always loved doing. I love writing. And then I love that process of, you know, being involved in photography. I've managed to write 5 cookbooks. I suppose that whole process is something that it's such a privilege to have been able to do, and that, you know, a publisher ever wanted to actually, you know, publish what I wrote. So I was writing for the Irish Times for 8 years. Actually, I did a weekly column, and That was just a wonderful time. And I think just amazing editors. Patsy Murphy was the editor of the magazine, and she brought me on board. And then Orna Mulcahy. And I guess it, you know, Roisin had her column. It was a wonderful group of people writing for the magazine at that time. And people seemed to just really connect with the column.
And was that an important platform for driving book sales, for instance? I'm sure it was.
Yeah, absolutely. One fed into the other. And yeah. I guess also it you know, when you're a food business, you don't have the luxury of huge marketing budgets, etc. So I guess it gave a profile to me, which then helped us in terms of the business. So everything kind of fed through to the same kind of goals as to what we were aiming for. But you know, and I eventually then I gave up the Irish Times. It's, you know, after a while it started to feel like homework, and a weekly column's hard, you know, and it didn't matter how efficient I was. Like doing the photography days, packing in about, you know, 7 weeks worth of columns into one photography day. You know, regardless of how efficient it was, it started to become a little bit of a drag. And I thought at that point, I need to give it up before I start turning sour, or they sour at me. You know, then I did a couple of years ago, I was writing for Food and Wine for and that was monthly, and that was a piece of cake in comparison. But it's such a wonderful process, you know, working with photographers, food stylists and editors. It's a great process.
It probably keeps you current as well in terms of
it does.
You need to be, you know, on top of your game.
Absolutely.
And you need to be researching and looking and tasting and all that good
precisely.
Stuff.
Precisely. Everything feeds into the one.
Yeah.
So it's wonderful. And I'm very lucky to have been afforded those opportunities.
Yeah.
Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr.
A News Talk original.
Brought to you by Standard Life.
retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.
Peaches, how important has PR been to the business? You know, Dominy writing in the Times, getting your message out there in various forums, your own involvement with EY and the Entrepreneurs of the Year. These are all very public forums. And, you know, how calculated has your presence at these events actually been in terms of driving the overall message? And calculated is a bad word. I know. No, I don't. I didn't mean to say it in a crass way. But, you know, it's a clever thing to do. If you can get people talking about your business, you know, you're doing the right thing, because you're ultimately going to get more customers out of it.
Well, as you said, Bobby, you have to remain current, you know, and people forget you very quickly, you know, and the world that we live in now moves at, you know, light speed. So you have to be out there. You have to be seen. But also, I think it's really important to learn, you know, and that's part and parcel of it is, and with the involvement with the Entrepreneur of the Year program, which is hugely important to me, and we're very lucky that we were nominated in 2011. That's a really important part for the business as well, because you learn so much. Networking is hugely important as well. And sometimes, you know, we're both asked to go and give talks to various groups. And a lot of the time the subject has been the power of networking. I can't stress how important that is. And also for anyone who's starting up a business is to actually go out there and meet people, because you just don't know what door is going to open. Yeah. And I think that's the thing, you know, it's the person that you meet, a conversation starts and leads on to something else. And suddenly you made that connection and you can pick up that phone. And I think that's what I've learned from all of this. And, you know, with the writing from Dominy, the PR, the getting out and meeting people, but it's the networking and the connections. And Ireland is so small. You know, you just don't know where something will lead to.
Yeah. And has networking changed over the years you've been in business? Like, it's still about connecting with people, telling them your story, maybe availing of opportunity that it presents itself. That's at a high level. But in terms of the day-to-day networking, people don't ring people anymore.
No.
People, you know, it's sort
text
of different.
Messages or Instagram or something like that. Yeah. No, I think it's, and, you know, COVID changed so much in terms of we stopped going into the office, you know, on a daily basis, etc. But that's starting to come back now. And it is that human touch, I think, is really important, because you can go into it, you know, you can have a Zoom call, but you can't read a room on a Zoom call. And, you know, you just see a panoply of blank faces looking at you if you're speaking, whereas you can tell what the reaction is if you're in the room. And that's why I think it's so important that you go out, you see your team every day. You might not see them every day, but you see them as often as you possibly can, and make sure that you're sitting down opposite the desk, because that's where you read people and you know if something's going right or wrong. But also in terms of the networking as well, you know if that deal is going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
you'll only know if you're
touch.
There.
Yeah, yeah, human touch.
If you're not there, you won't know.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, you mentioned the pandemic there. Was that a stressful and challenging time for the business?
It was everyone, you know, who was involved in hospitality. It was, you know, you wonder if you're going to come back from this. And certainly in the first 3 months, I remember just thinking, are we going to have anything to come back to? And, you know, there were a few things, like the government supports were incredible, you know, and I have to say, Pascal Donoghue and what he did was just, you know, he gave such comfort to so many people who were so stressed at that time. And, you know, and for that, we will always, and I know everyone in the hospitality business will be very, you know, very grateful. It enabled us to come out of it. But it also, I think what it did is it really made us analyse our business and see what was working and what wasn't working. And that was where we made a lot of changes as well. So it was really stressful, really hard. But it was also really good, because it gave us that time to stand still and say, are we being busy fools? Or, you know, where do we go with the business now?
We had survived, you know, the crash after, you know, Celtic Tiger, and that was an awful period, you know, as well for our industry, along with every other industry. But we kind of doubled in size during that. We tried to grow. We took some opportunity to try and get some leases that were going to be good value. But like our revenue pretty much stayed flat, but we doubled in size, our overhead. I mean, it was just a brutal time, and we tried to grow out of it, but it was really hard. And I remember we came off the payroll during that time, you know, everything to try and save jobs and keep the company whole. So when COVID happened, it was almost like PTSD of just like, oh God, this is going to happen again. And, you know, so I think we took very quick, decisive action during that period because we had been so badly burned during the recession. And I think that stood us well because we were quite ruthless about the things that we were going to keep or not keep, whether it was contracts or locations or leases. So that really saved us. And I think the really demoralizing thing was that period of people being laid off, then rehired, you know, then the opens and closures. And I remember actually being in the Commons Cafe and that call came in saying, yeah, government shut down again. And it was on a Friday. We had put in our orders. The fridges were packed, ready for a busy weekend, and then having to close. And it was that wasteful time. And of course, these decisions are out of everyone's hands. But it was just there was so much always to get a hospitality business open and closed, closed.
No,
and it was brutal, you know. And like I suppose we had good experience in being able to mobilize our teams, because we are used to opening up and concessions and new places. So we were probably fitter than a lot of businesses in terms of that period of frantic adjusting. But it was definitely a very trying period. And I know there were a lot of conversations about different potential partnerships and what we all might look like as businesses coming out of the far side of it.
Yeah. Peaches, you've said that running a business for sentimental reasons is a fool's errand.
Yep.
And your organization strikes me as being quite flat in, and as Dominie said there, you know, you can make decisions quickly. There's not a lot of layers of management to go through to take a course of action, be it positive or negative. Mm-hmm. But you still hold true to that then, that, you know, if you find yourself in a place where you need to change or fix something, that you just do it. Yeah.
Rip off the Band-Aid. You know, there's just no point in continuing to, and pardon all the puns, you know, flog the dead horse, because it just, all you're doing is wasting your time and the time that could be spent looking at something else or doing something else differently. And I think it's like, if something's not working, make the change.
Yeah.
You know? And even if it's a brutal decision that you have to make, make that decision. Because you spend, and I think it spend more time continuing to look after the thing that's not working well. You know, instead of, it's the good child, bad child syndrome. You spend more time with the bad child than the good child, you know. And I think that's, and business people will say that very often. And it's an ego thing, because you don't want to fail. If you have to hold up your hand and say, that's not working, that's failed, do it.
Yeah.
Cut it.
And the first thought you always have after making a decision like that is, I should have done that
sooner.
Two months ago, or six months ago, or 2 years ago.
But, you know, and I think it's about honesty, though, as well, and honesty with a team if you have to make those decisions, you know. And we analyse things on a, you know, weekly basis. We look at all figures, you know, it's just, and then do the analysis, then take it out, and you just say over the months, over the quarters, etc. But if there's something that's just not pulling its weight, it starts, the red flags start with me, and I look at it and go, I'm going to keep an eye on that, because if that doesn't start going the right way, we're going to ditch it.
Dominie, when we look at the changes around food over the last few decades, and I suppose how we live, how we eat, how healthy or not we might be, are you very close to food trends still?
Very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. And I think, you know, I've always been very interested in health and wellness, and I suppose the importance of food, not just from a calorie point of view, but in terms of it's what it gives us from a culinary medicine point of view, but then the wider question from a sort of social perspective. And again, we all know that people have now lost touch with sitting down at a table and eating together as a family. And again, COVID and the reliance on Deliveroo and so on, it has changed how we eat, often for very negative terms. And, you know, from my point of view, I have two daughters, and it's like it's kind of religious in the sense of sitting down for dinner and no phones, no nothing. And that's really important because now we see families all eating different meals in front of screens in different rooms. We are losing touch with the importance of actually what's on our plate. And that is a concern because we are now giving all of our control over to food companies and big food, who are delighted to be able to solve those meal conundrums for us. But the single best thing you can do for your health is to take control of your food and cook more. And I'm kind of agnostic about what you're cooking, because just to make a start and cook for yourself is hugely important.
I was reading an article, another food trend. I was reading an article yesterday that Jeremy Clarkson wrote about Ozempic and the effect as a society, that he had a dinner party and all these people came and nobody ate anything.
Everyone's pushing food around their plate.
And I just said, is that where we're at now?
Well, I think, and the really dangerous part of that is that Ozempic and all of these, they have a place for particular individuals. But the doses that they are giving people, it's, you know, up to $1,800 a month. You know, the FDA are about to approve it for children. We now have 75% of Americans, I think it's 80% of Americans, who are absolutely metabolically really challenged. The levels of obesity are through the roof. So pharma has come up with this wonderful thing, which are, you know, these GLP-1 antagonists. And again, in the right setting, they are very critical for people that really, you know, have the disease obesity and need help and support with that. So they have a place, but we now have it so widely available that, as you said, people are pushing food around their plates.
But he was saying, and just because I was fascinated by it, we need now, he thought, a restaurant that basically, as you know, supplies the demand that's required around somebody taking. In other words, that you go in and there's these tiny portions, of like really, really, you know,
like luxury foods, but tiny portions that will sort of satisfy. It is sad, but we also have a situation now where, you know, food companies were initially quite concerned because people's diminished appetites, what impact that would have on processed food. And of course, what they're doing now is they're looking at creating processed food with added fiber and added protein, because with Ozempic and so on, there's usually atrophy, there's muscle wastage. And also you're targeting the indigestibility of these products, because we know a lot of people suffer side effects of all sorts of indigestion. So these are the two things that things are now being wildly tweaked to supply people who are now on Ozempic. So, you know, the food companies are doing it. It probably won't take long before the restaurants, it'll deal with food waste, all sorts of stuff, you know.
Yeah, but I have to say it was an eye-opener for me.
It's very sad.
Because I just think that food is, like, I might be a bit on the heavy side, but I certainly don't want to live my life like that.
No, the love of food, there is nothing nicer than sitting down, as Tony said, you know, having a meal with family and friends. And,
Going back then to the business, and we've seen in the hospitality sector the challenges that there have been in maintaining and attracting first, maintaining. I don't know which way you want to put first, but it's been really challenging to keep staff, to find new staff, to get people to work in hospitality. And I read in some of my research that you like to consider your business as like a family.
Yeah.
And again, that's a leadership trait or a leadership style, that you want to have this family. And I saw it when we came in today, when we met some of your colleagues on the way up. Tell me a little bit about how you infuse that culture.
Well, I think, you know, it starts with people loving what they do. And, and so you have chefs downstairs who are cooking, who love what they do, but they also have to love the environment as well, and have a place where they feel safe, where they are valued. And I think that is huge. So what we really, you know, the leadership is, you know, I appreciate what you do. That's my ethos to them, is I appreciate what you do. And it's not just about, you know, we all work hard, and it's not just about churning stuff out, but it's about the person at the end of the at the end of the day. So it's to value them in terms of what they do on a daily basis, but it's to value them as a person, and to create that atmosphere that people want to come into work every day. And I remember hearing a very successful businessman saying, you have to like the people that you work with, because you spend most of your week with them. And I think that really, I remember, dropped with me. And I thought, that's the whole essence of that, because if you dread going into work, you're not going to stay in that work environment for very long. You're going to move out. So, you know, you have to be able to create that atmosphere. But I think it is also to allow the people, certainly the people that work with us, to create their own culture. You know, it's not about dictating a culture. It's creating that, allowing that culture to form, and to be there and to care about people as well. So it really is, yeah, I do try and nurture that family environment so that people feel it's a safe place to come into. And then it just doesn't all become about money. And yeah, I think that's really key.
And in creating that, you say you still work shifts,
yeah,
because that's how you know what's going on.
Absolutely.
People down there working the hours, they appreciate that.
They do.
When they see you, yeah, and they, you know, they can chat to you either informally or otherwise because you're there.
Yeah. So, and as you said, Bobby, it's, you know, you're going to make sure that everything, the standards are being maintained, that things are done the way that, you know, you like them to be done. But it is that whole essence of you're in the trenches. And making sure, and you know, very often Dominie and I, the place that we love to go to at a function will be to go to the wash up, you know, and love getting stuck in there. You know, like the guys are great at doing all the plating up and the cooking, but you know, I love getting stuck in, and at a wedding, you know, helping clear down, etc. So yeah, you know, it is that, and it's, and again, it's that camaraderie, it's that friendship. It's where you have the banter, and I think that's really important to have it. So you know, you're not just sitting at home and, you know, while they're all working their backsides off.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's we've had a lot of people that have been with the company for many years. You know, their home life changes. Often they have children, young children. So, you know, hospitality can be usually quite unfriendly to having, you know, it's not a Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 job. So again, you know, trying to find ways that people are able to be promoted into different positions and move up with the growth of the company. That's also been really important. But I think what we really have always tried to do is be quite ruthless with overly bureaucratic systems. We're always trying to refine what we do. Keep it simple. You know, I think you get people, and often chefs are the best example. You know, they could be amazingly creative, but they hate the paperwork. You know, they hate filling out forms, doing their hassle and so on. So it's trying to understand and recognize, you know, you might be brilliant at this, but you're going to be weak over here. That means that the accountant is going to probably hate, you know, you because you're really bad at this part. So it's always trying to manage and get the best out of people, and then putting other people around them that support those weaknesses or strengths. But I think one of the things that we really, you know, on reflection over the 25 years, you know, every now and then you have what they consider in management talk as those kind of toxic personalities. And there's been papers on it, and you can have one superstar. And they are amazing, amazing, but they cause mayhem for other people in the company. And the problem is that you tend to turn a blind eye to those people because of these fabulous traits.
Yeah.
And I remember reading about the personality traits of these superstars, and you have to be cutthroat. Like, you just have to get rid of them.
Yeah.
You know, and it's hard, but like the sigh of relief when that person's gone and you realize how difficult they have made life for all the people that are working with them. And I think that's been a really, really good lesson, because it's so easy to just turn a blind eye.
Oh, absolutely.
But you can't.
So 25 years in, none of us are getting any younger. What about the next 25 years? What are the plans?
Certainly, funnily enough, Funnily enough, to expand it to bagel again. Yeah, just did a brand refresh there last year
to finally do it.
Yeah, exactly. So actively looking for more sites.
And just on that, Peaches, again, you sort of look backwards to look forward there.
Yeah.
In terms of
completely.
Including the name bagel back in the brand.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe looking at some of the qualities that made it successful in the first place.
Exactly.
And re-highlighting those.
Yeah, yeah. And as we said, in you know, we've come full circle. And again, pardon the pun, but with the bagel, there you go. So, so definitely looking at that, continuing to do what we do. I suppose it's also about opportunities. You know, opportunities come along. You go out and seek them, but they also come along as well.
Yeah.
So it's that thing that goes in tandem. And yeah, I suppose continuing to do what we do and enjoy what we do and create something as well for the team. I think that's really, it's not just for us, it's to create something for the team and something that they look forward to as well. So it's constantly moving forward.
So Dominie, just before we go, can I ask you maybe who your leadership, I suppose, guru is? Have you anybody along the way that influenced you or that you look up to in terms of leadership?
It's a really hard question, I think, to answer, because there have been so many people along the way that have given great advice, great information. So many chefs I look up to, so many restaurateurs that have just done incredible work over the years. But actually, less about leadership, but I think I'm very concerned and about the role of food and the importance of food in our lives and where these food discussions go, because they tend to distract us from what we really need to be focusing on. And the last book I read was The Ultra-Processed People by that UK chef, Chris Van Tolken, I think his name is. And he's done an amazing job of bringing a lot of these food arguments together. And ultimately, he doesn't really give a damn what you eat, as long as you're eating in an informed way. And I think that position is something I'm so conscious of, because we have these nutrition wars and everyone gets distracted and starts arguing about what we should and shouldn't eat. And really, he's keeping it very simple. That ultra processed food, we need to be careful of it.
Yeah.
And we need to be careful of how it's infiltrating our lives and society, from government policy down to schools, to institutions, down to the family home. And I would really encourage people to buy it, read it, and understand now, while we're at a critical tipping point with our food supply and what we're putting on the table. So I think from, you know, our point of view, there's a lot of business that we do in relation to food from a commercial aspect, but I think we have to be able to keep these bigger and wider concerns. We have a responsibility to do it.
Sure. Peaches?
Well, actually, I'm going to say my sister.
Good.
Yeah. She's sitting here and she's probably going to burst into tears and I'll go, ah! But anyway, I am going to say my sister, because I think she is a great leader. Yeah. I think she,
nice.
And I think what you do actually, Dominie, is that you lead with compassion, you lead with love and respect for people, but also you test the boundaries. I think this is the thing that I think is really great. And she pushes me. She pushes everyone. Sometimes I want to kill her because she pushes us all. But that leadership is really important. And I think, you know, I've learned from her a huge amount over the years. I hope she's learned from me too. But I think what Dominie does is, and I think this is why our partnership has been so great over the years, is that we are able to talk to each other and ask each other questions and sense check things. And I can sense check things with her. So, and I know she can do it with me. But that leadership is, you see, there come the tears. I think it's really important. Yeah, I think it's
well,
really
how
important.
Nice. What a lovely thing to say.
We're really lucky. So we're very lucky.
Yeah. Well, look, I want to thank you both for joining us on Life and Leadership. Sorry about the tears at the end there.
I feel like I need to change my answer. Can I say my sister?
Gotcha.
But it's been great chatting to you, and I really appreciate you joining the podcast today.
Thanks,
so, Dominie and Peaches Kemp, folks. Thanks
very much.
Thank you.
Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr.
A News Talk Original.
Brought to you by Standard Life, a life savings company for your journey to and through retirement.
Hi there, it's News Talk's Andrea Gilligan here. This Black Friday, Mars Pharmacy is making wellness simple, and the savings are seriously impressive. It's the perfect time to look after your health from the inside out, starting with 25% off Simproof, the award-winning water-based supplement packed with billions of live and active bacteria to support gut balance, digestion and immunity. Because a healthy gut really does mean a healthier you. You can also save up to 35% on Zuki's liposomal vitamins, from collagen to vitamin C. They're your daily boost for glowing skin and immune support. And if you're plant-based, there's 25% off Dr. Vegan, bringing clean, effective nutrition with zero compromise. From gut health to glowing skin, Mars has everything you need to feel your best this winter. Shop these Black Friday wellness deals and more in-store or online now at mars.ie. Now, enjoy the podcast.